Hello and welcome to the Game Dev London podcast, a community of amazing people who love talking about and sharing their love of the details behind making games, whether or not they're actually based in London. I'm your host, Oscar Clark, he, him pronouns, and I'm on a quest to understand everything you wanted to know about game dev, but never dared to ask. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Mark from Gaslight Games, and Mark and I are going to have a chat about what it's like to kick off starting a project. Mark, I'm going to bring you on screen now, he says, remembering to press the right buttons, he says. Hopefully they'll kick that in post. There we go, Mark. Lovely to see you. Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, so I'm a game developer, mostly a programmer based up in Yorkshire. I've been in the industry for 10, 12 years, something like that, and I've worked across everything from my own projects, one-man band, through to indies, AAA. I've done VR, console, mobile. I've even done stuff on 30-foot giant screens, and the lovely fun that an interactive game with a camera works on that. So
Amazing. We'll have to get into that one later. Our conversation earlier, we thought it would be good to start talking about what it takes to get started in a project. And there's a lot of things. Now, when I tend to get involved, it's normally when things have gone wrong and people ask me to sort of come in and give them some advice about how to save it. And sometimes you can, but most of the time you can't. And it'd be so much better if you could start off in the right way. How do you think about getting started?
Well, I think more recently, I think the biggest thing right now is that everybody is, or a large number of people are going remote. I think the pandemic has kicked that off, and it's definitely shown that that is something to be looked at. But we made the jump on that in 2016. Yes.
I've been remote for 10 years. Sorry.
Exactly. I think that's definitely a large part, and it's certainly demonstrated a lot that there are many more things that one needs to do and shift how we're thinking about making games if you go in a lot more remote. There is something to be said about being in an office and bouncing ideas off around people and body language and things. But
and human contact. There's a nourishing part to human contact. We mustn't forget that.
Absolutely, absolutely. But like the biggest thing for kicking off the project for me, I mean, I'm mostly technically based. So unfortunately for me, my other half is a producer, project manager. So
that sounds like a good combination. Used to be told what to do.
So I think the first thing that I would want to sort of say on this side of things is that it's about building up your structure. About how you're going to run the project. So best practices, one of the big ones for me is code formatting, format rules, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And it's not so much about strict that I think we should code in this way, although I do have lots of opinions on that. but it's about standardizing. It's a standard language.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd go slightly earlier. So for me, I think teams need to work out what it is, why they're doing the things and how they're going to measure success. To me, that's the very first thing to do. In fact, when we do consulting kind of work, and it's always the same chart. In fact, I was doing a session for Yuki with some Russian developers. And my first exercise is basically, here are lots of reasons you might choose to make a game. Not the game, not the genre. Well, they might be connected to the genre. So you might have a passion for a genre. That's okay. You might have a desire to make money. That's okay. You might have a desire to win awards. But for my mind, it's like getting the team to agree the core things that drive success that are not around a single game. Because I think that when you've got an industry where something like 1 in 20 game ideas just fail, if we just hang our hats on one idea and not think about what success looks like as a team, I think we kind of flounder very quickly. I mean, do you have any views on that?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think there's a large part. So a lot of the teams that I've worked with, they have a big technical debt. And that's certainly where I come in and I help a lot of factors. Yes. But I've mentioned already about production and things, and they have this very large idea of what they want, but they don't have the core, or they'll know what that end product is. They want that to look like. They know how, everything is going to be this super shiny particles. Oh my God, it's going to be amazing. And it's like, cool, baby steps. And I am certainly guilty of this myself. but it's about those baby steps. And like, sorry, you know, I've mentioned like code formatting and things, but yeah. A big part for...
But I love those things. To me, that's process, that's framework. But I kind of want to, I want people to agree the things that they're going to use to make decisions first, personally. That's why I think if I know that you want to be the market leader in a particular subgenre, and you're going to measure that by the ranking of each game as being in the top X of that subgenre, fantastic. Then we've got not a pillar, but a direction which can drive vision of the company. So when we come to decide this game, okay, what about this game is going to make it possible so that that will then be in the top 10 of that subgenre? And then in order to deliver that, we need these other bits. We need this structural agreement. Like, this is what a spec looks like. This is what code formatting we're going to use. This is the way we're going to write a variable. Are we going to use lowercase first letter, uppercase second letter? Yeah, sorry, second word type thing. You know, the sort of things I mean. Is that how we're going to make it so it's clear when someone reads this code that they know what they're doing, or when they read the notes, or when they're going to set enter variables in LiveOps? All of that stuff needs to be there, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have other stuff. So there's like the folder structure of what you're going to do. And that certainly plays, like, I don't know how many people have been bitten, but Android has a thing of lowercase everything. It doesn't like uppercase. Now, lots of tools, Unity, Unreal, they can auto do those. But if you have set yourself some structure on that, you can minimize what that impact's going to be. And similarly, like naming convention, we use a prefix for everything. So a lot of that stuff, again, when we've come on with other people, they've kind of gone, oh, it's like, why? You know, certainly a lot of this stuff that I mentioned now, these big things, they kind of just look at them as an annoyance or a frustration. And it's like, no, I've been on stuff. You might be able to see it in the background, but Guitar Hero, when I joined that, it had been going for about 4 years, and the rules were still in place and so strict, because 4 years on, we minimize what broke. And that's such a big thing.
So what we're saying here is we're trying to lay out what it's going to take to make it so you don't waste money later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's the bit that will bite people. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, we've talked about a number of those things. So, I mean, so do you start with a game in mind, or do you start with a team in mind, or do you start with a player in mind when you start out, or are you simply looking at where is the money to make this thing? You know, how do you think about getting started?
So if it's one of our projects at Gaslight, then we try and think about what would we want to make. And also, like, what would you want to play? But there is that obvious problem of, once you start building something, are you still going to want to play it? And of all the games I've ever worked on, including my own, and I am so very proud of literally every project I've ever worked on, some of them I don't ever want to think about again. Oh, God. But I'm so proud of them. But there's literally only ever been two that I've actually wanted to play.
It's really tough as a designer or a coder, not just because we have to play it endlessly to make sure it's right, but because it's a bit like looking at your any piece of art that you might have done. I'm a terrible artist. I cannot draw. my sketches of people are basically scrappy triangles that could have been done by a spider walking through ink. But it's that emotional pain of looking at those things. You go, oh, that wasn't what I wanted. And when I see that with games that I've worked on, it's like, oh, but it could have been this, it could have been that. And I think everybody suffers from imposter syndrome. Everyone suffers from that kind of sense of self-deprecation. At least everyone I've met who's actually worked hard on it.
I think it comes from a passion. You know, the biggest thing that we always say with our stuff is that we give a hoot. And, you know, like, I've just finished up sort of the stuff, my side of a game called Smash Punks. And it's not garnering as much momentum as we'd have liked. It's a big online multiplayer game, so it needs a community. But of all of the tools that we've put into it, you know, I've got it working with online physics, melee, replication, crashing, bashing. It just does things that no one else has ever done. I mean, a lot of it was definitely smashing myself in the face with the keyboard until I got an answer. And so that passion, that caring, we want it to succeed and to you know, and that's the same. I feel that when we start a project as well, I get that the new and shiny, which is always a big risk, because you don't want to get stuck on it.
Yeah, and I think this is part of the tension as well, because we have this knowledge that at the end of the day, we have no control over how the player will receive it. The only control we have over that, and this is the approach that we take, is to basically test as early as possible. So for me, when I'm starting out a project, that's why I have these goals that I have tests associated with. But I also then use that to work out who it is I'm going to target from. So, I mean, to be honest, actually what often happens is I have an idea for a game and then I retrofit the audience and the measures to it. And I shouldn't do that. That's the wrong thing. Don't be me. Don't be Oscar. Do what Oscar says. Don't do what Oscar does. If you work out what your goals are as a studio and you work out what individual ones, not just, you know, what are the most important things that the whole team agree with? And if you've got three or four of those and they've all got markers on, then when you come down to making decisions about games, I find it much easier to do that. But having that list of like processes of agreed behaviors, things like stand-ups, you know, are you going to follow a scrum or a command? Are you going to do a hybrid? Everybody does a hybrid. Don't pretend you don't.
Yeah, we do a hybrid.
Do you know what I mean, though?
Like, how 100%.
How many obsessive Scrum people tell you that they're 100% Scrum and actually they're doing a little bit of waterfall on the long-term planning, they're doing a little bit of Kanban in terms of individual tasks? You see what I mean?
Oh, for sure. And similarly, like on that idea of coming up with the users, we do user personas. We do it in reverse, mostly because we think of the game idea because we're trying to think of, I've got like nine, I've got pages and pages of prototypes I want to make. Yes. And so I've got all of these games that I want to make that I'm passionate about. And as the company leader, you know, we get to pick that. Yay. But then we want to make sure that we're actually going to focus that in a place that will not only be marketable when we come to do that, but that we know what that player wants. And so we'll use thispersondoesn'texist.com. I think it's that's the site.
I don't know that one. Oh, that's a new one. I'm going to check that out. Thispersondoesn'texist.com. I'm going to look now.
It randomly generates faces from other faces. It's an AI that will build a face. And I might have got the URL slightly wrong there, but a Google search will pull it up.
Looking at it now.
And so we use that. And then when we come up with our user persona, we give people a name. So, you know, we were saying, right, we want the game to be mostly played by sort of 12-year-olds. And then that unlocks a whole load of other things, certainly legal elements. But in highlighting that, we also came up with this thing of when we have been at shows and there's been kids games, there's actually been a lot of parents there. So we want to make sure that the user persona of the parents are in there too, that the game we're doing is not just another violent shooter, which, you know, we don't like making it. To be honest, I don't like making them anyway. I play them a lot, but I don't like making them.
Well, they're a particular set of skills, should we say.
Yes.
Sorry.
And so from that whole sort of side of things, we can then create these, like I said, these user personas, and then we can use that to feed back in. And so we use it as a double-edged thing, in that if we're going down this path of what we wanted the game to be, and we go, this is what we want the game to be, and then we start thinking about what the user's going to do, and we also think in line with what a streamer might want, or what particular streamers we might be thinking, or content creators, and then use that to again feed back in and go, right, well, that path we were going to take isn't going to make good content. Or that might be great if it's a single-player game, but we're doing online multiplayer, so that's not going to work. So we try and look at it in those methods. And similarly with the stand-up as well, you know, bringing things back around every stand-up, every sprint, and reviewing it, constantly reviewing it.
I think that's really important. I think this is one of the things that when you come from a kind of like traditional kind of development process, you're often driven by milestones, and you may not have, depending on the scale of the game, it might be a little harder to test components of the game than maybe something like a hyper-casual game, although I've got thoughts on that. The idea is that the fact that you're constantly thinking about it, that you're finding opportunities to take the uncomfortable truths and embrace them, I think that's really critical to the success of any team.
Absolutely. And it can be very, very hard, because there's certainly parts of things that I believe in from a technical standpoint or an engineering component that, you know, most teams should have and use. And I get very soapboxy when people don't have or use them, because I have seen them save my bacon. I have seen, like, as a big one here, version control, I'd saved my behind. I cannot say how many times that has saved me. And when people say, oh, didn't have it when I was making games, like, it existed in the 70s. You did. You just don't did. Use it. And it's please use it. Please.
Version control is an absolute kind of must, I think. I mean, what's interesting is when you try to use like Dropbox for version control, and it basically can't. I mean, I love Dropbox to bits, but I wouldn't use it just as my only version control tool, because you're basically, you know, up to so many potential risks there.
Yes.
But do you go for the whole Confluence structure or Subversion or one of those kind of big infrastructure approaches? How do you look at that?
Yeah, so for version control, we internally use Subversion. I just have for 15, 16 years, so it's just habit. But they, you know, Git, Mercurial, Perforce, pick your poison. They've all got great pros. They've all got horrible cons.
Yeah, I said Confluence. I'm in Perforce. Sorry, I don't know why I said Confluence. When I was at Sony, we used Confluence, Perforce, Jira. But we also had to do Bugzilla because the Japanese team, I think, used that rather than Jira. But I can't remember. It's been a long time. But I basically just ended up hating all of those systems. I try to avoid Jira. I get why people love it. I get why it works. But you've got to be all in on these things, I think.
Yeah. Well, on the project management tooling, we are Jira, Confluence. We tried everything else. I say everything. Yeah. We tried many others. They just lacked. Jira had the least lacking, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
But it's like a JCB, or for those who don't, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine last week. A JCB is a big mechanical digger, and trying to use that to crack a nut. Some people are trying to crack nuts. Other people are trying to dig big infrastructure projects. And I think Jira is perfect for that big infrastructure project. It might be a little bit overkill for somebody who is just trying to make a one-man band or a small indie game, I suspect.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's where things like Hack and Plan are definitely very helpful. We found that Hack and Plan, when you want to get above about five people, it just from our personal experience of where we found it stops being useful. But then that's when you start hitting into JCB territory, or at least Bobcat Mini Digger. you need something that's in the middle. There's also some like on the whole tooling side of things. So we found that we actually switched to Discord for all the voice chat, and the video chat with 25 people in one channel is just phenomenal.
It's huge. I mean, we tend to use Google Meets, weirdly, because it's easier to schedule. But we do use Discord as well for kind of team catch-ups. But we use Slack extensively. And the reason why we use Slack is because it's got great APIs. So, for example, we can run attendance bot, which lets us know who's in the office or not. We can run Notion. We can have updates to projects being, you know, transferred. So we use Notion as our kind of wiki kind of hosting. And actually we use it to run Kanban style planning. But it means that we can actually make our projects all in one place, and any client can get access to their part. So any game developer we're working with on publishing, they can get access to a complete version of what they need. We can just cut and paste the templates. Makes life so easy for us. It doesn't have the ticketing systems. But again, I suppose what we're really talking about here is not the specifics of what we needed as a team or you needed as a team, but that whoever's starting out a project needs to make sure they know what the tools their team are going to need, and that that can scale to where they'll need to be by the time they release that game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, a big one we're saying there about being able to feed back in and use bots and put the resources in APIs. You know, we have stuff that, so we have a build machine as well. So we have a separate version control, separate build and automation machine. And we hook that back into Discord with a bot. It's on its own channel, and it just pops up and says this build was good, or, you know, we can at somebody, you know, we use the same handles and stuff, and we can.
We use the same principle when we were exact producing a couple of things. We use the same principle with Subversion, plugging into Slack and posting updates when builds were ready there. In fact, I think we actually were using the Unity Cloud build process for that as well, which I found made it life a lot easier for us at the time. I don't know how useful that is for other people, but again, it's down to the teams and how they work best, isn't it?
I think so. I think like you know, we were saying, so some sort of project management planning tool is a must. Spreadsheets is not okay. Yu Suzuki, who did Shenmue, even said, I wish we didn't have spreadsheets in the 90s, because they ended up with tens of thousands of rows to try to account for everything. And it's just unmanageable. So
I love spreadsheets.
We use them so much, but not for planning. Please, not for planning. And then similarly, like version control, there are so many. It's like you can just pick one and you don't have to use what everybody else uses.
But back in the 90s, I was using Microsoft Project and I loved it. I know it's not everyone's favorite cup of tea, but there was one thing about it which I still miss to this day. And that's to be able to work out what your critical path is very, very quickly. Now, yeah, there are other ways of doing it. But actually, if you had worked your system about how to plan with it, it was functional. And it had these little bits that were still quite useful. Like, one trick I had to do is I can never put more than half a day's time in for any person. The reason is because if you put more than half a day's time in for any person, you never take into account holiday. Little things like that were nice little tricks that I could do at the time. Now, they're bizarre and stupid. And you would never really do them in the real world. They were just hacks to get the tool to work. And that's, again, why we should take advantage of the fact that we now have some amazing tools that can do it properly, that can actually take into account things like holiday properly. And you can do sensible planning, at least.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think this is like one of the big things that we're saying about all these tools is that you do try and find ones that work. But the biggest one that we've had too many times, and you know, when I first started doing like buddy checks, when we first started working with companies that would do that, it was completely alien to me at the time. This is 10 years ago. And you know, not long after out of uni and everything else, and I'd done many, you know, system administration, server networking, so you don't buddy check that. but it's such an important part. It doesn't matter what your department is, because it will keep the integrity of the build, so that when everybody gets the latest. Yes. Oh, yes. And that, you know, and so, like the contrary of like the build, so buddy check, sorry, and a build machine. Is that the works on my machine, if you buddy check it and you can see somebody working, okay, then it should work. If it fails on the build machine, then you can narrow down where the problem was. And it can notify you more quickly. You're not, you know, certainly like I use Unreal Engine and we use stuff for source if we're doing stuff on a console. I've got to build that from scratch. Now, my machine is about 40, 45, 50 minutes, including the game. So build server is about half an hour, but then I haven't got to do it. And I can just hook the dev kits up to the server half an hour and it will test on every platform, come back and say yay or nay.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just,
That systematic planning about what it is your game company is going to do, how you're going to do it, and how you're going to make sure that your communication of how it's being done is managed properly, but also working out how you can do it in the most efficient way possible before you even get started.
Yes.
It saves you so much money having all that stuff in place. I mean, you know, it can make the difference between getting to the end of the process and running out of cash because you've wasted the cash on having to refix things you wouldn't have done had the communication been working or had the test process been planned.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. There is a fantastic video by Butterscotch Games. Sorry, Butterscotch Shenanigans. Called Stress-Free Game Development, Powering Up Your Studio with DevOps. And so if anybody wants to see how they handled it and did it as baby steps and little pieces just to isolate what's the biggest current cost right now. So as an instance there is my cost was building the builds, packaging them in a zip and uploading them. You know, check that onto a build machine. I haven't got to do that. It just takes all that time off. Yeah. And then whenever, you know, you'll see lots of places they talk about a nightly build or things. And it's like, this can do it on every version control commit. And now that build is up to date and just, you know, ready to rock and roll. You go, oh, we got those latest. Yes.
It's all branching. If you do it automatically, whether it's on a cloud or whether it's on a machine, you know, set it up so you can roll back because you're going to have to.
Yes.
And one of the biggest problems we have is getting devs to remember to set up rollback. So, you know, as a live ops person, you know, that's my kind of key area of passion. I need to be able to make sure things aren't just tests on the machine, obviously, But also, once they're QA'd, I need to regression test. I need to deployment test. I need to make sure that not just the modules were checked, but the integration testing was done. I need to know that, you know, you're not breaking somewhere along the path. You know, the fact that trying to get people to do a smoke test where they check all of the APIs inside the modules of each game actually provide the right information, or stub testing, which I haven't bothered to explaining stub testing to my business partner. It's just too complicated. She used to be a coder. I don't know why I shy off some of these like different terms, but you know, being able to test before all the modules are available is a good thing, and we shouldn't be afraid of testing things. You know, as long as we know what the outputs should be, we should be able to test that we're getting those outputs.
Yes.
And I think having systematic, I can't test enough. But then you are talking to somebody who spent Sony. We had 16-week test cycles. Can you imagine that? PlayStation Home had 16 weeks of testing each build.
I mean, I can see the benefit. I can see that it would minimize the risk of what was released, but it just seems...
It wasn't good. It wasn't good. Well, it was mostly a waste of time. But the idea was...
There's an excellent video again, because these are all ones that I regularly keep. And when people go, oh, not so much why should we do that thing, but if I say, hey, we should probably do this thing, it's nice to have a big AAA say we do it too. And Sea of Thieves from the folks from Rare have got plenty of stuff talking about how they did games as a service, live ops, release cycles, automation testing, and the things that they talk about how they were able to reduce bug counts in every release, how they were able to maximize what goes out, catch stuff on the testing constantly. It can increase the dev time per commit. Yes, it can. But once you start getting into the flow of understanding where those tests can be run and how they can be done, you will improve the overall quality of the product. And eventually that's what we're after.
So in your approach, I mean, obviously testing is part of it, your code Bible, or whatever language you use for that, has to be kind of locked down. So the kind of the structures, the formats, the asset file structures, the naming conventions, these are all things which from a coding point of view and actually from a kind of testing point of view are all important to lock down. Do you go as far as doing test-driven design? So basically when you do your coding, are you writing the test cases before you code, or are you doing that when you're testing the code itself?
So if I'm building a new feature, like almost completely from scratch, then I will get the feature going first, because it might be that, oh, right, that can't do that. A big example, again, in Unreal is you've got maps and dictionaries and arrays. Well, maps and dictionaries can't be replicated, only arrays can. So it'd be like, oh, that's really convenient, I'll use a map or a set on that. Oh, no, I can't. Yeah. So I'll need to swap it to an array. So instead of having to rewrite the test to handle those. But then I'll write the test. But we also use a combination of Gauntlet, which is an Unreal facility. But the folks who are doing the new Golem game, oh, their name of the studio has just jumped out of my head. Daedalic Entertainment. They've actually released a plugin that hooks in so that you can create the test cases inside of Unreal's editor in the blueprints. Okay. And so it means that I can get designers and artists to actually create tests as well. It's not just pure C++.
I like using kind of use case in my requirement definitions. So actor sees, actor does, system does, and any dependencies and any... data issues. I think the last one is, I forget, because I each game has different requirements, so I do play around with it a little bit. But to be honest, I often forget, if you run out of time, it's the first thing that goes, which it shouldn't do. But I think it provides the coder with so much clearer understanding of what you expect that function to do, and at the same time, it's already the use case for the tester. So I think there's something about, from a design point of view, if you can write use cases, so this is the behavior and this is what the user sees before and after that behavior, and this is what's going on in the back end, this is how that data is being captured and utilized, these are the variables that you're going to use. If that's all in that description of the requirement, I think it saves a lot of time and cost for the developer. The important thing is that it should never tell the coder how to code it, just what the outcome of the experience should be.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. So we even go, we will start that in the planning phase when we're coming up with each individual user story. And so we will specify as a target. So if it's literally an internal tool, it'll be as a developer, I want this tool to do this because of this. But we might say, like, as a player, I want my character to swing their sword so that I can be in combat. That's a terrible example because it's too wide.
A bit fluffy, a bit too much.
Yeah, it needs to be narrower than that. But
step by step, you can have multiple steps, and you're describing multiple steps in one there, which I get.
And so then that means, right, okay, as an engineer, I need this character to receive an input. I need them to move the skeletal animation. I need them to have a melee weapon. I need the hit detection. And that's where that would be scored and broken down. But then when you pass that to automation testing and we want to build those things up, we pass it to actual, like, literal QA, they can look at it and go, okay, so I should be able to swing this weapon and it do melee damage. Cool. Yeah. Does it or does it not?
Exactly.
And you can start building those things up. And we do a similar thing all the way through the entire phase, generating the release notes from the commit logs as well.
Yes.
And then that way they should tie back into what was in the task so that we can then, we you know, custom format them
so
a little bit.
So clearly nothing will ever go wrong.
Oh, so in fact, one of the things I've got on my list is before you even start installing any tools is update all of your software, whatever it is that you're doing at the start.
Interesting.
Because for instance, we are a small team, absolutely tiny team. When I've worked on AAA, they've had dedicated engine teams. And within that, they've had dedicated platform teams. So, you know, two or three people dedicated for PlayStation, Xbox, et cetera. And when Microsoft or Sony, et cetera, they bring out a new version of their SDK, you can bring that up to speed. They can integrate it to the engine and everybody gets it seamlessly and there's no problem. When you are where we are, if I wanted to release on the Xbox and I was using a two or three version old of Unreal, it's going to be two or three version old of the Xbox SDK. I'm not allowed to release it. And so you've got this double-edged sword of, well, do I upgrade every release of the new version of the engine, which then automatically has the integration, or do I try and do it myself, or do we get an external? And it just, there's all of these considerations. And
but I think there's also a tension there, because my advice to people generally is to do as little as possible until you can test it, and to build up layers of testing on the grounds that once you've got proof, it's worth doing that work. So there is an argument that you want a stable version of Unreal or a stable version of Unity, and therefore going and upgrading to the latest one at the start of the project may not be the right thing to do. You may want to do that once you know that the core game mechanic is functioning, and then you're starting to get ready for the new release. How do you feel about that sort of tension?
Yeah, so there's definitely a 6 2/3 of this side, because Visual Studio, for example, the new version's out, but I'm still on 2019 because it's the most supported across Unreal's toolchain and many of the other toolchains that I use for other development. And so there's one that I won't touch because it literally, you know, it's on the paper, it's like, doesn't make sense. We did an upgrade of Smash Punks and then rolled back, which is a great example of being able to roll back, because there's a weird bug on 427 that causes one frame a second on Steam.
Ow.
But if you run the build with Steam running separately, it's fine. Only when you deploy, and we're not the only people. There's many people who've had that issue.
Oh my god, one frame a second, I kill me now.
And it doesn't make sense, because the exact same executable, you know, we did SHA testing of the XE and everything's the same, but it just
I remember we had a problem where, because the way the assets for Home, I always go back to Home because it was in some ways the more sort of technical kind of functional role I had. But what was interesting is we had a particular, I think it's FMOD, you know, the audio kind of tools or whatever it's called. Maybe physics, I can't remember, but one of the tools, possibly more than one, were locked into the way that content was designed. So it meant that old content would have to have been updated by the third party who made it across the board before we'd be able to upgrade that tool. So basically, we were locked in to having old tech because they hadn't planned being able to upgrade content that somebody else had made without affecting the actual source of what somebody else had made. Little kind of consequences like that need to be thought about really early on.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I think this is one of the biggest problems of the way that a lot of tech is designed, is that there is a, it works for this use case. But there needs to be a thunk about the decoupling between the core data, perhaps some sort of interface in the middle. I don't mean programming interface, but some way that communicates what that is. I mean, that's what an API is for, but you might even need another API to be able to take things off.
And middleware layer in between the APIs. I mean, we're joking, but actually there's a whole bunch of really good things that happen if you have flexible middleware layers integral to your design, particularly when you're looking at kind of monetization models. But obviously there I'm talking more about mobile generally. But you know, there is definitely some argument to have an API for the, you know, to rule all APIs. I think some people even try to market some of those. But I think more importantly, I think it's really understanding, you know, what are you trying to achieve with the game, and then finding these structures that you can put in place. So for my money, putting as much on the server as possible makes life easier. Particularly if you know what the game is looking for, because then you can update things, you can adapt things. But you're never going to get away from the fact that at some point your client is going to have to be updated to be able to accommodate, you know, tech changes on the platform, on the device, on the engines, or whatever else, what other tools you're using. How do you feel about sort of server versus client changes like that?
I think if it's so, you know, I think some of the biggest examples here are on Guitar Hero. We had there was an SQL Lite database. The online element's turned off, so it's you know, I'm not going to hurt anybody now. But there's an SQL Lite database that we could change all of the parameters rather than it being text files in a zip or anything else like that. And that's where a lot of the parameters and things for quite a lot of the online elements could be done. And because it's SQL Lite DB, the whole thing was a few meg. And that's where so many of the data elements could be just pushed and patched and updated. And then similarly, all of the content that was streamed or adjustments to those things, or there were some elements to the networking. So on that side of it, it feels like it's real time, but it wasn't. It was an awful lot of turn-based elements to it. And if I flip over to Smashpunks more recently, because it's Unreal, because of the way that it works with the builds and everything, if the two versions don't match, it doesn't, you can't play. So it's, I think there's a 6 and 2 3s here. I think if you can offload a lot of the data elements to something, you know, like I say, SQLite, or an actual proper SQL database and some sort of API that can communicate.
Well, we generally don't use SQL stuff anymore. We're using a lot, well, not strict SQL stuff. So we're using a lot of JSON format generally, but generally event triggers with parameters. So they're not necessarily relational database structures like an SQL format would generally be. We're trying to, you know, minimize the need for that. But of course, we still need to understand what the framework of that data is in some way, even if you don't have relationships between each data point. So yeah, we tend to put long, you know, human readable JSON things and then encrypt them and all sorts of other fun stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we're still talking about a database, whether what kind of database you're talking about, whether it's a MongoDB or whatever, or if it's non-SQL or a whole bunch of different ways. Frankly, I don't care how you decide to store these things. The important thing is having the ability to make changes without having to do a new build does free up so much possibility. But you've also got to be careful about how easy that can be to break the game, particularly when you're running live ops. So that introduces a whole layer about what your security is going to be, what your rights access is going to be, what things you want people to be able to change or not, how you protect the data, how you separate account data from, you know, which might include some personal data, from telemetry, which must not, in my opinion, include that kind of telemetry data, particularly nowadays with the ICO's children's code, with the Advertising Standards Association's guidelines on monetization, with GDPR, the list goes on. Privacy and data hosting is so important, but I don't know how many game studios have legally trained data protection officers.
Well, like if we're talking on the client side as well, that was the other part of it, and these kinds of data, and keeping them up to date, that's where another part of this whole procedure of picking out how you're going to start your project can come in, because you can figure out how you can get content in pack files and pack loading, so that in theory your core executable changes minimally, or you know, if it's a Steam update, for example, then the executable might change a few bytes, and you can minimize the actual download of each, the actual size of every download by those kinds of approaches. But ultimately, the amount of benefits that you can get from a client update when you do these sort of micro changes can offset the cost of doing so. And as long as you have that set out in your plan of release planning that you figure from the start, you know, so if you do pack updating and things, a good example again is on Smashpunks, we were doing some actual multiplayer testing on real dedicated servers, and we got network traffic come back, and CPU usage was the lowest that we'd seen on this provider. Memory usage was the lowest that seen on this provider. You know, we'd taken a lot to make sure this would run at 60 frames a second on the Switch. I am so proud of that. But the network usage was the highest they'd ever seen for an 8-player multiplayer. And so going back and looking through the client, and it's like, okay, there are loads here where we don't need to send that. I'm sending tons and tons of 32-bit things, so we can quantize that to 16 or 8 or not even send it. Doesn't, you know, there's Glenn Gafferon Games, Glenn Fielder, I think his name is, has some fantastic talks on the quantization and actually explaining it in English as opposed to reading a paper on it.
Sounds like I need to listen to those.
And that whole element seems so completely alien to me, you know, mostly working on sort of gameplay stuff and that kind of thing, but then coming and having to do servers and gameplay and networking and engine and the whole shebang. But if you highlight that at the start, again, right, we knew that we wanted this to run on Switch. We knew that we wanted to run on potato PC. We knew that it needed to be low latency, or as low as you can possibly handle it, which is, you know, there's not a lot we can do about infrastructure, but we can minimize our traffic. So when that came back, it violated one of the core tenets that we'd set out at the start. And so being able to dedicate some time and resources to that aligned with, as you've already said, a decision made for the company at the beginning of the entire project.
Exactly. And actually, I think there's a whole bunch of other things that we can go into more detail on. I think it's whole flow, planning out that you're going to have to do submission. You're going to get those submissions rejected, whether that submission is directly to the platform or via a publisher. Publishers, if you're going to go via a publisher, are going to be having certain requirements which are going to be necessary for them to do. They're going to take time reviewing. They're going to take time feeding back. They're going to run their own tests, probably. I know we do. We run extensive tests, because we're going to do a what we call a CPI test. Well, it's not really. It's more of a fake ad where we see what the game is going to be potentially, how well it's going to be potentially received. It's a cost per click, but we're kind of using it to estimate what the cost per install could be. We're then doing usability tests, and we're looking at, you know, like the first 30 minutes of play. We're seeing whether we'll get a good net promoter score. So would somebody recommend it to a friend? Each stage could require a change that's found because we found this issue, go fix it. We found this other issue, go fix it. Then we get to day one retention, day seven retention, day 30 retention. Each of these phases aren't just a case of we might need to test it, those tests take time, but also they may trigger a reason to act. In fact, they should also, if you do it right, also trigger a reason to stop and kill the game, so that you don't spend all of your money making something that's never going to work and still have time to go back to the drawing board and pivot and build something that will work. But how many people sit and think about that from day one?
I think that's a very large part that comes out of the sort of side of prototyping, pre-production, and that kind of planning at the beginning stages. You know, if you prototype the game or pre-production, they're not the same, but they have the same targeted outcomes of trying to identify the fun, highlighting high risk elements of and solving them if you can, or highlighting them, going, okay, we'll work around that in this prototype, but in the full game, we like this game, but in the full game, we need to fix that properly. Identifying those core gameplay loops, you know, and then it's often, it's the discussion we were having right at the start, where we really should identify our players and feed that in. But sometimes you might just, you know, if you look at the Double Fine Amnesia Fortnite prototypes, they just, the developer just thought this would be a fun game. And oftentimes you really shouldn't shoehorn your marketing in that direction, but oftentimes that is, as we know, what happens. And then let that feedback into it, and then bring that up into your planning so that you can try to add these buffers. You know, that's one of the biggest things, is that, I think that's going to take me 2 weeks. 13 days comes up, or 9 days if you're working on 5 day working weeks. I've not done it, and it's where was the buffer, where was that giving yourself that care just in case something goes wrong.
And but this is why I like KPI driven milestones rather than functional driven milestones, because I want to de-scope everything I can rather than miss, I actually quite happy missing deadlines, but budgeting wise we're not, because we still have to pay people as nice as possible. Oh, apparently that's a good thing. And I will never do crunch ever, just no, not doing it, because you can't do it as a living game. It's just, it's impossible. It's not healthy, it's not sustainable.
Agreed.
So I want to de-scope. I'm happy to de-scope, provided we can work out what the KPIs are. But when I say de-scope, I mean be prepared to kill the game early. If I can't get that KPI, let's stop mucking about and let's do something that will get that KPI instead. It doesn't mean we're getting rid of the team at all, far from it. It's the opposite. It means that I want to protect the team, and when I'm looking at planning, I'm looking at, okay, what are all the things I'm gonna have to take into account to get this game to life? What's the budget I need, the run rate to do that? Okay, where are the breakpoints in this that if things go wrong, I can still get out a game that's going to make a profit? They're the things I want to bear in mind. And I think you can't do that unless you take a team with you. You can't do that unless you're pivoting continuously as data comes in. And that means when you have an original idea of a persona, you change it as you find out more information, which is why we do the ad test. That's why we do the usability test. That's why we do the retention test with real players, because we actually want to know what real players want and do with the game, not just what we think they should want and do.
I think you've highlighted the sort of middle and late stage use cases, in fact, across the entire board, but of agile methodologies. Which pick whichever one you want to use, the hybrid, as we've already said.
It's always the hybrid.
But it's like, if you are able to do that and you can pivot, then you can respond to market changes, or you can kill it if it needs to be killed. But I think from this whole thing, a couple of things that really helped me when we were trying to figure out this stuff is because, I'm an engineer, so figuring out how to solve a problem is my bread and butter. Thinking what a player wants coming into the game, I mean, I know what I want when I play, but that's not what I'm looking at. And I found that when we have worked with the designers and artists and company focused, player focused, is that they will come up with the player centric top down, and I will come up with the engine tech focused bottom up. Well, as the tech people will, and where we meet in the middle, that's where the magic happens.
That's where you can
find these things, or they go, oh, we really love this idea, and I go, that's 6 years of stuff, no one solved that yet. Oh, well, we'll kill it then. And you can't meet in the middle, and that's one of those beautiful bits that we can get the best out of it.
I completely agree, and I think one of the things that I found most fun about being a game designer is you're wrong and you get less wrong over time. I know that's a terrible way to put it, but it is. I mean, our job as designers is to make sure that you guys as tech folk can deliver something that will waste as little money as possible. I'm stealing that, by the way. I'm misparaphrasing my friend Ty Kelly, who was writing a book on the topic, where he basically talked about game designers being about cost saving. He was joking, and it makes sense if you think about it as well. But anyway, so we are running out of time. So I'm going to ask you, what is the one piece of advice that you would give someone who's starting out today? What are the things that they should get in place? What's the most important thing they should get in place first?
I mean, I'm a tech focus, so I would say your tooling, because it can help to minimize that cycle. But at the same token, if you start to come up with your plan and your project, and it's not going to, you know, you're already like, this is 3 years, 5 million, and I can't raise that, the tech's not going to help you. I think personally, the weird Donald Rumsfeld quote, the old unknown unknowns, is if you go through the 4 points of that, you think about your known knowns, known unknowns, unknown knowns, and your unknown unknowns, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you can only plan for 1 and 2. You can't possibly plan for 3 and 4. But that's where your contingencies and your mitigation of risks can come in to help you. If you think about those 4 points as best as you possibly can, that's where you can, across the whole board, across what tech you're going to use, across what the game's going to do, what the personas are going to be. Somebody, you know, there's a random console is going to drop tomorrow, which is sits firmly in 4.4, in 0.4. Once you think about it in those frameworks, though, that approach, when you then look at it from your thinking of your tasks and your project, it will start to fall into place. That it did for me. And like I say, I'm tech, so this is one of those production tools that really helped.
No, exactly. I completely agree with that. And things like you said about asset structure, making sure that asset structure you've got is designed in such a way where you can handle localization and reskinning and repurposing that game for other games. All these kind of things can be thought about at the earliest stage. And if you do, it saves you a whole bunch of time, pain, and so on and so forth. I think for me, a strategic person, I'm always going to say the most important thing is to agree your top three things that matter to you about why you're making games at all. Not just a specific game, but why you're making games. And those things need a measure. You know, how do you measure that has been successful? If you've got those three things and the KPIs associated with it, when you come to look at the audiences, the game design, the technical requirements, the infrastructure, the planning, all that kind of stuff becomes a lot easier. Because you can always go ask yourself, does that get me my KPIs? And it just simplifies a lot of the pain that you're going to go through, because everybody then has clarity about what they should be doing at any point. And it's always the thing that's going to get those three KPIs met. So that's what I would look at. Mark, that's been fantastic. So where tell people how they can get hold of you and what you're up to at the moment.
Right now I am wrapping up a lot of the technical elements and server-side stuff on SmashPunks. I'm working on a few little prototypes, really trying to learn some more about Unreal Engine 5. It's not yet released, so I want to be able to do some stuff with that. We're also doing a whole bunch of other cool stuff with virtual reality, and you know, I want to do more with the giant screens and weird projections and productions.
Talk about that. Oh, that sounds so cool. I'm on Twitter. Stuff with laser pointers against big, huge panels, where you could have hundreds of people playing the same game with laser pointers. It was really cool.
Yes, that was. I saw that at one of the GDCs. It was very, very cool. But I'm on Twitter at Mark Jordazak and at Gaslight Games, follow us on any of the usual places as well. Same handles.
Great. Mark, thank you so much for that. It's been a great chatting to you. So this has been your Game Dev London podcast. I've been your host, Oscar Clark. Obviously, if you are a game dev and whether or not you're in London, please check out all the other amazing podcasts and talk conversations that we've got going on. And I hope that we've left you knowing a little bit more about what to think about when you're getting started making games. And that's been another stage on my quest to learn everything you want to know about game dev, but never dare to ask.